You know ID, ID in the D in the town all day. ID, ID in the D in the F E A. You know ID, ID in the D in the town all day. ID, ID in the D in the F E A.
Hello and welcome to episode number 230 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
But we're both really in the greater Seattle area, in Seattle, Washington, as I tweeted, now home to the four-time WNBA champion, Seattle Storm.
Incredible! Four-time champions, winning in 2018, taking a year off for injury, and then being able to retool, proving the haters wrong, every single one of them out there, all one of them.
Those haters being you?
Proving them wrong and coming back, going into this crazy situation, heading into this bubble and winning a championship. And really, they didn't go in as the number one seed, but they were the most dominant team in the WNBA throughout the entire season.
And they really backed it up in this series against the Aces, who admittedly were playing without one of their key players and the sixth woman award winner, De'Erica Hamby, who missed this series and they missed her. But by the way, we shouldn't get into this before we got a toast to the Storm.
Yeah.
We got a toast with this week's beer. We're continuing our Fremont Fresh Hop series.
How many freaking Fresh Hop beers do they have? And so, why is it not enough?
So I was DMing with them and they were like, have you tried something else? There was like a hazy Koichi Canyon version that apparently it may only be on draft at the Urban Beer Garden, so we'll have to look into that. But I asked you last week, hey, should we do this other Fremont Fresh Hop beer as our beer of the week? And you sarcastically replied, should we do a Fremont Fresh Hop beer? It was that clear, which it should have been, what the answer was.
I'm not in the wrong here. Like, this isn't a Seattle Storm type situation. I was in the right on that one.
This is the Fremont Head Full of Fresh Hops, Fresh Hop Hazy IPA. Starts with select fresh hops harvested in Yakima and loaded into the brew kettle. The gold on white text is a little hard to read here.
Oh, it's really hard to read, yes.
Within 24 hours of harvest, fresh hop beers signal the harvest season in the Pacific Northwest and are the height of our brewing year, they're also the height of our drinking year. Check out our website for the malts and hops used in the fresh hop. So I'm gonna have to do that while you fill here.
You think this is the height of the drinking year? This is normally tailgate season, so I think it definitely has to be the height of the drinking year.
But just like fresh hop season, it's my favorite season.
It's the best beer that we drink throughout the year. Fresh hop season, September, October, when the hops are fresh. And clearly Fremont is doing it right with all of these different varieties of fresh hop beer. And this is one thing where, you know, breweries, they go too hard on things. I don't think I'm not being too bold to say if something is working for a brewery, they will produce so many different varieties of that type of beer. Fresh hop beer, I want all of it. Give me your fresh hops. Give me your tired, your weak, your poor, your fresh hops. We want it all.
Those are not like the others. Fresh Mosaic and Equinot hops here.
There we go. I'm excited to see if we can taste the Equinot hops.
The aroma is pineapple, tropical, grapefruit, fresh cut grass. I don't know, that could be a trouble for my grass allergy. Pine and black pepper flavor, medium bodied with light sweetness and moderate bitterness. So there we go, a toast to the Storm on the fourth WNBA championship in franchise history.
Oh, I got a little bit of grass there, a little hint of grass.
Now the Storm have won as many championships without me as a member of the organization as they did during my 10 years as part of the organization.
Oh, no. Well, let's start by talking about this series. You know, the Storm with a pretty dominating 3-0 victory. None of the games were even that close, right?
I mean, game one and game two, you know, Vegas tied, I think, game one going into the fourth quarter, had made a run in the third and the second half of game two as well. And then both times the Storm pulled away in the fourth quarter of those ones, really used their depth. And this time it came much earlier as they pulled away in the second quarter and Vegas never really threatened thereafter.
And obviously, you know, Sue and Brianna are the team leaders of this team. But who really stood out for you during this final series?
I mean, I think everyone did in their own way. Like, it's not like they didn't. Stewie was the unanimous MVP. She had finished second to Asia Wilson of the Aces in voting for regular season MVP. And she showed everybody in the series, particularly in game one, when she had maybe the best game in WNBA finals history. I think it was 37-15, and Asia Wilson went 6 of 20 from the field. It was like, this is the real MVP. Like, we saw it on display. I mean, Sue, I think this was probably the best of her four WNBA finals at age 39. She set the single game record for assists. I think she finished with the highest assist average in a WNBA finals in WNBA history. The Storm set the record for assists in a game in game two after tying it in game one, and Sue was at the center of that. And then, I mean, you just go down the list. Jewel Lloyd struggled a little bit in game one, but was awesome in game two and game three. I think when we talk about this team versus the 2018 team, one thing that needs to be mentioned, in 2018, the two series clinching victories the Storm had, game five against Phoenix in the semifinals, game three against Washington in the finals, Jewel Lloyd was not on the court for the fourth quarter of either of those games or for the stretch run. Sammy Whitcomb, who did not play in this series because she headed back home to Australia to try to make sure that she's there for the birth of her and her wife Kate's first son. So, you know, hoping that happens. I got a story coming about that on ESPN.com that may be up by the time that you listen to this podcast. But Jewel was awesome in this series. Really made Vegas pay for their difficulty defending the pick and roll with their size. Alicia Clark, she struggled in game one, too. Couldn't make a shot, then had 21 points in game two. Natasha Howard was huge in game two. Mercedes Russell off the bench playing big minutes, because Brianna Stewart got in foul trouble in the first half of this game Tuesday night, game three. And the Storm extended their lead with Brianna Stewart on the bench, which is wild. And then Jordan Canada, big minutes off the bench. Epiphany Prince had double figures in game one. I mean, really, everybody who saw action in this extended action in this series played a huge part in it.
It's an incredibly deep team. And I was going to say, it's almost easier for Sue to have this kind of performance in this finals when you're playing with such a deep team.
That's always been her strength. Like, it's when she plays with the national team. She almost never shoots, and she just racks up assists because she's got so much talent around her. That's her, like, natural state.
Okay, so a couple of Pantheon questions for you. Number one, where does Brianna Stewart rank as far as all-time WNBA players at this very moment?
I mean, she still doesn't have a long enough resume that I think she's probably, like, top 10 all-time. I don't think in career terms she's yet past Lauren Jackson, who had, you know, an equal number of championships, had three MVPs to Stewie's one. So, you know, she's not yet at that level, but she's also 26. I mean, she's got a long ways to go. She does already have as many MVPs and as many finals MVPs as Diana Taurasi, who is by acclamation the WNBA GOAT, even though I made the case for Tamika Catchings earlier this year.
Yeah, I didn't really know who the clear, like, WNBA GOAT was.
People go with DT because of her playoff heroics, and then she's the all-time leading scorer, and, you know, points mean value to most people. So, she gets that title, but Stewie is definitely coming for her. And the other thing we did left unsaid, like you mentioned, you know, Stewie and Sue, the Storm haven't lost with both of them. That's the and Natasha Howard, I guess, you have to add her in to differentiate from 2017. That's the Celtics haven't ever lost with their starting five intact in the playoffs. You remember that one? Back in when Kendrick Perkins was hurt in the 2010 finals and KG had been hurt the year before. But for Stewie to do all this, to be clearly the best player in the world, to dominate the WNBA Finals, after suffering an Achilles injury, like, there's no precedent. That has never happened before. It is wild.
Incredible. Okay, so Sue, I mean, this run is basically unlike anything we've ever seen before. Going to four different finals spanning 16 years? Like, I was basically in high school. I mean, I remember going to the clinching game of the first championship at Key Arena. There used to be a men's basketball team in Seattle. When they scored, like, think about how long it feels like it's been since the Sonics were here. Sue Bird has been a steady through that entire time period.
I mean, I was thinking the other day, like, there's not many players in sports who have had a career like Sue Bird's. I mean, it's fascinating because, you know, part of what I was thinking about is there was a couple of questions that I posed on Twitter over the weekend because Russell Wilson has been so awesome lately. Mm-hmm. And one was Bob Condotta of the Seattle Times saying, I don't know if any Seattle athlete has ever played at this level. And a lot of people replied Sue Bird to that, including Lynn Dunn, the Storm's first coach. And it's like, she's not actually the right Storm answer. The Storm answers are either Lauren Jackson or Breanna Stewart, because Sue Bird has rarely been the best player on her own team. She's never been the best player in the WNBA. But then when you look at the totality of her career and how long she has been, you know, this, I don't know when I want to put it, like, top 10 or whatever, but like how long she's been a really good player and contributing to winning, I do think has an argument. Because Evan Hill tweeted that Russell Wilson was, like, solidifying his claim as the greatest Seattle athlete ever. And it's like, whoa, I think Russ is well on his way, but he hasn't, you know, call me when you get to year 17 like Sue has. Call me when you get to championship number 4.
Who do you think is the compare? I mean, Stockton, I think, is the one that people go to, but never won a championship. But consistently good for a long period of time, but Sue is now in championship 4. I mean, LeBron was the best, has been the best player in the NBA so consistently during that time. LeBron's better.
Yes.
Within that sport. So that's tough. But LeBron's the only player who has had that consistent and extended time period of success at such a high level.
I mean, that's why Stockton is the really good comparison, because of the fact that, you know, he was a quality NBA player right up until he retired, I think, at age 40. So, you know, Sue's maybe going to get there next season. And was typically not the best player on his own team because he played with Karl Malone, but laid the argument that he was, you know, I don't think he would say that Stockton was the greatest point guard of all time, because, you know, Magic is probably that, and Stockton might not even be number 2. I don't know exactly where he is on the list, whereas Sue is, like, clearly the number 1 point guard in WNBA history, but...
Taurasi is considered a shooting guard?
Yeah, she's played some point guard, but you'd call her a shooting guard. That's where they play when they play together for the national team.
Okay, so this stretch, these championships that have extended over almost 2 decades, you know, we have championship teams in 2004 and 2010 with the Sue and LJ combination, and then now here coming back again in 2018 and 2020 with the Stewie and Sue connection. How do these 4 teams compare to each other?
It's an interesting question. I've given it some thought. 2004 is clearly the weakest of the 4 teams.
Wow.
The Storm had the best point differential in the league. They weren't the number 1 seed in the Western Conference.
The shade for Benny Lennox.
I love Benny. Look, the 2004 title team holds a very special place in my heart. That was my first time, you know, working, my first year working full time for the Sonics and Storm. And it was like, oh, great. You just work for a team and they win championships all the time. That's what happens, right? Not so easy as it turns out.
PJ Carlesimo's Sonics did the same thing too. So,
but that team, you know, they were the number 2 seed in the West. They got a little bit lucky that the number 1 seed LA got knocked off. They went to 3 games in both of their, you know, the Western Conference Finals and the WNBA Finals. They nearly lost the WNBA Finals. Nikisha Sales had a shot to win the finals in game 2 that fortunately went awry. So that to me is clearly the weakest of these teams. Yo, your microphone is popping. That's better. Then, so I think it's an interesting question between the last 3 teams. I mean, 2010 had the best regular season record. They set at that time the single season, or tied the single season for record for wins in the WNBA, became the first team ever to go 7-0 in the playoffs. So that was a really good team. But I think the argument against it is that 2010 team really relied on winning close games. You look in the regular season, a lot of fourth quarter comebacks. in the playoffs. Many of those games, even though they won them all, were close. The game two, they had a comeback in Phoenix in the conference finals. In the finals, all three games against Atlanta were very close. Could have lost any of those three. So I think that contrasts with the dominance you saw from the playoffs in 2018 and 2020. I would probably put, even though they didn't have as good records, I would put 2018 and 2020 both ahead of 2010. And then if you're comparing between the last two championship teams, I mean, it's a little tough to make the comparison because, like, the league is not whole this year. And one of the big disappointments is we never have gotten to see the Mystics when they were at full strength, last year's champions, against the Storm when they were at full strength. They played the Mystics in the finals in 2018, but Elena Delladon was hurt in that series. She wasn't 100%. And like 2019, Mystics were way better when Sue and Stewie were out. And then this year, Delladon did not participate because of, you know, the concerns about her being high risk for COVID due to her Lyme disease. And then, you know, Vegas in the finals, Hamby's injured. They didn't have Elizabeth Cambage, who didn't participate at all. She was also medically excused. Delladon chose to sit out and didn't have Kelsey Plum, who missed this entire season after an Achilles injury. So, you know, it's a little tough to make those comparisons, but still I come back to, like, 2018, 2020, it's generally all the same core, but Jewel Lloyd was much better and more consistent this season. Stewie was just as good, and the bench was better in 2020 than it was in 2018 because of the fact that you had that year where Jordan Candid and Mercedes Russell started all last season for a playoff team, and now they were coming in off the bench as depth. That was a huge luxury for Gary Kloppenberg.
Wow. So you're saying this is the best Storm championship team of all time?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I'm subject to recency bias there, but others may disagree with me.
Do you think that the league in general was the competitive balance greater in the early 2000s? Are there are less teams now, right?
Then in 2004, yes. It's the same number as 2010.
Okay. So it shouldn't be that great of a difference. I mean, you just look how deep this team is and how, you know, it's kind of interesting that they ended up being the number two seed because it felt like they just kind of dominated the entire season.
Yeah.
And it's one of those seasons where you just need to point to point differential more than anything else, as, you know, they dominated there and they did the same in these playoffs, right? Like, they had one close game.
Yeah. The very first game they played, which they hadn't played in 9 days at that point, and they had dealt with the previous 2 days. We haven't talked about this yet. We reminded people of this. They hadn't known whether they were going to be able to play because you had the multiple inconclusive tests on the morning of game one of the semifinals against the Lynx. So, you know, that was – and Sue and Stewie at that point, because they hadn't played the last two games of the regular season due to injuries, which is how Vegas was able to win that final game and get the tiebreaker, you know, they had been over 2 weeks at that point without playing a game. And so, you know, not a surprise that they started slowly at that point. And then from there, they just kept getting better and better, I think, as the playoffs went on.
Awesome. Well, I suppose we'll see what happens with this offseason, but it feels like they go into next season as the prohibitive favorites again. And, you know, maybe it'll be exciting to see a more whole Aces team. And if Elena Delladon can play next season, and there actually could be some high level competition for the Storm.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be really interesting. Last year was, you know, they had the new CBA, and it was the most exciting offseason we've ever seen in WNBA history, I think, in terms of, you know, star players changing teams. And then a bunch of them didn't end up participating, unfortunately. Like, you know, Tina Charles got traded to the Mystics, and then we didn't see her this year because she also opted out. So, or I think she was medically excused. So it'll be interesting to see if those players are able to participate in 2020. And then we'll see what the new salary cap means for the Storm, because
2021.
Yes, 2021, I should say. Because, I mean, first off, Sue's future is always in question. She was asked about it tonight, and she said, like, I can't say when I'm going to know because I got to figure out when I start, you know, working out and training for the season how I feel. So, you know, she has every intention of coming back for next season and certainly wants to play in the Olympics one more time and add to her record total of 5 gold medals.
God.
It's Sue's career, man. Or four gold, better.
She
She's
really
going
is like
five.
Stockton, but with just winning.
Yes.
Right? Stockton has one. He has one gold medal. Never won in college. Never won in the NBA.
He might have two gold medals. I think he was on the 96 team, too.
Oh, yeah. He was like the only player who played on both teams, right?
There was a few who did.
Drexler? Maybe Drexler did,
Barkley
too.
Played in 96.
Don't
ask me to go through off the top of my head players.
We've definitely done that on a podcast before.
We did the 90. We tried to do the 94 team.
That team was more fun.
not as successful.
But, like, you know, those are gimme. And maybe they are for Sue also in the Olympics. But, like, you don't, you're not like, wow, Stockton really achieved at the USA level, right? Like, he managed to win with the dream team.
Yeah. I mean, he barely played in 92 because he was injured.
They managed to beat Armenia by 75 points.
There's a little more question about whether the U.S. is going to win gold. And Sue was on a U.S. team that did not win the World Cup in what year was that? 2006, I think.
But that's what I'm saying about Sue Bird, is just consistent winning across the board. There are tons of players who've gone to UConn and have won championships who have not played in the NBA or in the WNBA and won championships. And for Sue to have done this at the college level, at the NBA level, stretched over two completely separate eras. You know, I remember actually here's a good comparison for you. Maybe not quite right, but there was a Football Outsiders piece from like a decade ago about how Jerry Rice basically had two careers. And for Sue Bird, there are these two specific eras. There's the LJ era and the Stewie era, where, you know, she's maybe not the best player on the team for either of those time periods, but just this constant steady for these two periods that are lasting for such a long period of time. And it just does not happen in professional sports. But then to come away with gold medals, with five gold medals. With
she's got a chance for five. She only currently has four.
Four gold. Four gold medals, four WNBA championships, and college basketball NCAA tournament championships. Like, this might be the greatest career in the history of women's basketball.
There's not a career like it.
Also, a Pelton Cast appearance, which I have to say, none of the other – Diana Taurasi has declined the invitation. Left on red from Diana Taurasi.
Wow. I didn't know you were reaching out to her. Rice is an interesting comparison because
you tasked me with that request.
Yeah. I was like, let's go with you on that one. No, you just didn't even tell me you were doing it. You wouldn't say that he was the best player on those Niners teams in their heyday. You would say that was Joe Montana and probably Steve Young in the second era. But he's also the greatest wide receiver of all time. So that is a reasonable comparison from that standpoint, although he was probably a little closer to being the best player in the league than Sue ever was. The other thing I was thinking about, reflecting on these last few days, I remember the first year I think that Sue played overseas, which might have been like the 2004-2005 offseason, because the previous year, as we never talk about, she had microfracture knee surgery 17 years ago. It's just kept playing. She won a championship playing one of the years she won a championship playing overseas in Russia, and you know, the Storm's PR person at the time and I were like going, she was like talking about all the championships that Sue had won. And it was already a really long list, and this is like 15 years ago. She's won so many more championships since then.
Wow. Winning Russian basketball.
I mean, it's yeah. It's,
well, I think
it's awesome.
Again, one more toast is in order to the Storm for this incredible season under very strange circumstances, and to Sue in particular, and Stewie for winning the MVP.
Sammy Whitcomb for another championship for the Dogs? Okay. Yeah, so we'll see.
Sammy Whitcomb after she didn't play in the finals, but yes.
It was an unusual situation, and I urge everyone to check out my story where I talk about it.
That unusual of a situation?
To be in a hotel room by yourself while your team wins the championship? Yeah, I think so. Half the world away?
She just in a hotel room?
Well, there's a mandatory quarantine when you go back to Australia. And then,
oh, man.
And then she has to quarantine when she flew into Sydney. Then she has to fly from Sydney to Perth. And she has to quarantine again.
Oh, my God.
4 weeks.
So this baby hasn't been born yet.
It is not.
It's just preparation because there is so long that you have to wait with these quarantines.
Correct.
That makes – because I thought that was kind of a strange situation. I was like, just play in the game and then fly back. But
it's not that easy as it turns out.
Wow. Okay. It's basically like she has to get on a fucking ocean liner and sail across the Pacific.
It's close to that, but fortunately there's better Wi-Fi than if it had been that situation in the 19th century.
So did you talk to Sammy? I don't want to spoil your story here. You talked to Sammy from the hotel room because, spoiler alert, she's got a lot of time.
Exactly. It was like I told her, this is the best time I could have possibly asked you for an interview, right?
Those fines aren't going to sweep themselves.
Yeah, I checked her on Saturday after game one for the bulk of the story and then checked in with her tonight after the game. So that was cool. I do want to say for next year, by the way, free agency is going to be interesting for the Storm. I mentioned that last summer or last offseason was so interesting. Alicia Clark and Natasha Howard are both unrestricted free agents. So, you know, we'll see. We'll see what happens there. So we should probably have cherished the opportunity to watch this Storm team because it might not necessarily be the same team in 2021.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
With that in the book, should we talk about Seattle food?
Seattle burgers in particular.
Yes, it is a burger-heavy discussion here. First off, some more updates on Dick's, which has announced the search for an East Side location. You'll recall that Dick's opened a location in Kent in December 2018, joining their 5 Seattle locations, all of which have been operating since 1974, and one in Edmonds that opened in 2011. Fans can go to the Dick's website to vote on stops for their coming food truck, which we talked about previously, and attempt to influence the location choice. Dick's also announced the first 5 stops for the food truck this fall, which will be Bellevue, Bellingham, Everett, Renton, and West Seattle.
How long is it going to be at these places? That's what I want to understand. Because when they're announcing these stops, like, is it they're just spending a day there, or is this like a pop-up type situation?
Unclear. That I've not seen information about that.
Can I give some like kind of hot Dick's takes? They're not gonna be negative about Dick's food.
Okay.
You gave a skeptical look. Look, I had Dick's on Sunday and it was superb. This is nothing about Dick's burgers because they are excellent. But the idea that the location that they have, their South End location in Kent, like, I'm sorry. Kent is a very large place. Kent is, in fact, the largest place on Earth. That is not Kent. That is in Midway. Right?
It is basically
in Federal Way. Like, that is the deepest part of Kent you could possibly be in.
It's closer to Des Moines than Federal Way, though, isn't it?
It's, like, on the I-5 corridor.
Yes.
I'm sure it's in Des Moines. But, like, literally, Kent is like 2 blocks from my house. My children are in the Kent School District, and the Dick's location that is in Kent is the farthest place away from me on Earth. It would be faster for me to travel the other direction and come all the way back around.
It'd be faster to go to Sydney and quarantine.
Yes, to get to that Kent location than to drive direct. So I'm a little bit skeptical about this East Side location, about what the East Side means to Dick's. And if this fucking Dick's location ends up in Kirkland, which I know it's going to, it's just like, fine, it's fine. It's whatever.
It seems logical, yes. I would not be surprised.
But they've already got a damn Shake Shack, right? Like, Kirkland doesn't need you, Dick's. The people of Renton would cherish you, right? There is nothing like Dick's in the city of Renton. Downtown Renton, I have to say it. I don't want to go on a limb here. It is an emerging neighborhood. Downtown Renton is the new South Park.
Renton was not an option for – I guess it's not an option for where the food truck is you could go, but that's probably because it's already been
– It's already
selected.
Going there.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Downtown Renton is the new cool place to be.
Is it? I mean, there's some hot chicken we need to check out there.
We've got hot chicken. There's the Boon Boona. Look, everything is happening in downtown Renton. We've got the 8-Bit. Like – That's where you need to be, Dix. The people of Kirkland are not going to care about you. The people of Bellevue are not going to care about you. But there's one place that is going to actually cherish a Dix location, right? And that is downtown Renton. I'm just saying it. To what Loretta's is to South Park, a Dix in downtown Renton would be the same thing. However, if a Dix is in Kirkland, if it's in Bellevue, it's another fucking restaurant, right? It's just whatever. It doesn't mean anything for the community. It means nothing for the neighborhood. It's just walls.
I'm skeptical of all of this.
This is an impassioned take, though.
It was. I don't disagree with that. That was basically a hot takes with Tristan. I guess you said it, declared it as such. In other burger news, Lil Woody's Fast Food Month is underway.
There we go.
It started Tuesday with the Woody's Baconator, and you know I had to do it. Get it on the first day so I can talk about it on the podcast.
You had to do it to him.
I, for whatever reason, when Lil Woody's has done Fast Food Month in the past, I have not done the Baconator. I think presumably because of the fact that I have never actually had the Wendy's Baconator.
I was going to say, I think I might have had a single Baconator one time. We might have been underwhelmed.
The Fabulous Pelton Brothers stick pretty solidly to the value menu.
Dog, if you have a 4 for $4 at Wendy's, it's the best deal in fast food. Why would you ever stray? Why would your eyes look from anywhere aside from the 4 for $4 at Wendy's?
I don't know.
I'm sorry, but a Baconator on its own probably costs more than $4. Get 2 for $4 for $4 if you want more food.
Well, the Woody's Baconator definitely costs
$8.
Definitely costs more than $4. It's clocking in at $10, and it's still a great value at that.
Wow.
This was among the best Lil Woody's burgers I've had.
Really?
I don't know if I'd put it ahead of the mac and cheeseburger.
Okay, carry on.
I certainly wouldn't put it ahead of the Felton Casper.
I was going to say, I think we know what the best Lil Woody's burger is.
But I might put it ahead of the Little Big Mac as far as Fast Food Month.
Get Rainier Tallboys specifically for this Baconator?
No, they did not.
All right, fine. We're changing the game over here.
Next week will be the Sourdough Woody. Little Big Mac will be week 3, and then finally week 4, the Little Crunch Wrap.
I'm kind of anti the Little Crunch Wrap.
I don't think I've had that one either, but I've made a goal, even though there's not, you know, a prize at the end of it like there is for Lil Woody's Burger Month, I'm going to do all 4 of the Fast Food Month sandwiches.
There we go. Look, Lil Woody's downtown Renton, it would be a... look, you said you were going to open up an airport location, and then it just went away without you telling anybody about it. I'd be booking flights to anywhere right now just to get Lil Woody's.
Only because our journalism has been inadequate on that subject. I'm too busy talking to Sammy Whitcomb in her hotel room to check that.
DMing Fremont Brewing.
No, they reached out to me. I didn't initiate that one. I appreciated it, though.
Should I make the effort for a Baconator, though?
Yes, you should.
All right. We'll see. Maybe this weekend. Good. Okay, so how these last in... traditional Lil Woody's fashion for their burgers of the week, they go Tuesday to Monday, right?
Correct.
So we're going to have the Baconator available until next Monday, and then after that we're going to have the Sourdough Woody.
Correct.
Which I have had a Sourdough Jack before. What have you had those?
A Sourdough Jack?
Yeah.
No, but I have had the Sourdough Woody. I'm pretty sure I did that last year, and partially because of the fact that I definitely wanted to do – they were doing curly fries, and I love a good curly fry.
My only issue, I was scrolling through on Instagram, the post about Fast Food Month, is that they didn't bring back the crisp burritos. The Lil Crunch Wrap to me is just like, I don't really like a Crunch Wrap to begin with. I've had one ever, and I'm just like, no, I don't want any crunch in my tacos. But that they didn't do, you seem skeptical about that.
What about your Dorado tacos with cheese from Birria Tijuana?
Is there a crunch?
I think there's some crunch to it.
That's not the same.
Also, were you not eating the double decker?
No, fuck. I hate hard shell tacos.
I don't prefer hard shell tacos because of the problem that hard shell tacos have is that they break apart. And then you lose taco meat. You lose the ingredients. And no one wants that. But Taco Bell solved that by putting a soft tortilla over the hard shell tortilla.
They just don't taste good. The soft tortilla is good, and the hard tortilla is bad.
This is a bad tech. The internet's going to agree with me.
I mean, I suppose so, because you're coming in pro a fast food item. Look, the internet will stand with me on the 4 for 4, people.
I mean, that wasn't a debate between us.
Four items. $4. Come on!
I'm right there with you on that one.
It's just like, okay, here's the thing. Maybe you don't do a Taco Time crisp burrito. Maybe another Taco Time inspired item.
Taco Burr. We're still waiting to do that.
Freaking Taco Burr. Like, if they announced that, they would have broken the internet. And by the internet, I mean people who are sort of in the Pelton Cast / Lil Woody's purview of interested in fastish food from Seattle, Washington.
Correct.
They would have broken that particular internet.
Anything else on food?
Did you have the pumpkin snickerdoodle from Bell's?
I sure did.
The famous cousin Katie brought us today.
Yeah, Katie Eats was delivering. That was great.
Katie Eats. Did you have thoughts?
I thought it was good, but not as good as the chocolate chunk. What did you think?
I mean, that's a pretty high standard to compare it to.
Sure, but that still exists.
It literally is not as good as the chocolate chunk, because any snickerdoodle cannot be as good as any chocolate chip cookie.
Correct. I mean, not any, but the best snickerdoodle cannot be as good as the best chocolate chip.
It was definitely up there with the best snickerdoodle cookie I've ever had, though.
It was very good. Definitely enjoyed it. All right, it's time to get back to sports with the NBA Seattle update. We're back on the rundown, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci they're not four-time champions. They're every-time champions.
There it is. Isaiah Thomas in the news telling my ESPN colleague Adrian Wojnarowski that he underwent a hip resurfacing procedure in May to address the hip injury that has bothered him since the 2017 playoffs. Thomas says he now has a full range of motion in that hip and no more pain. Hip resurfacing, if you've never heard of it, which I hadn't, is a less invasive alternative to hip replacement surgery, where instead of replacing the entire hip of your femur, the femoral head, the kind of ball that goes in the socket there, you instead just cap the damaged part of the femoral head with a smooth metal and then still replace the socket with a metal so that you don't have the bone-on-bone that Thomas was experiencing previously. Mm-hmm. Dr. Edwin Sue, who performed the surgery, has done so with professional athletes in the past, but not typically in as high impact sports as the NBA or as young as Thomas. So it'll be interesting to see how he's able to come back from this.
Who are we talking about?
Well, he's specialized in WWE. There's been a couple of WWE wrestlers who have had this performed. There was also an NHL player.
The Undertaker.
I think possibly, yes. I forget who exactly it was. There was an NHL player who was the first pro athlete in like a team sport to have this done and return, but he was like 37. It was the tail end of his career.
I was going to say, I don't know. And what hearing Isaiah Thomas and young, although I suppose Isaiah Thomas is not that old. He just seems old.
Right. He said in there, his quote was, "I feel 31 now." Which I thought was a little funny, because I would have said, like, I feel younger than my current age. But the point he was making was that previously he felt much older than 31.
Wow, look at the honesty. Not seen at the highest levels in the country.
Well.
And I just would kill to feel 31.
wouldn't we all? Not all of us, I guess.
My back hurts from a bike ride.
Seattle Kraken news. NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman said the league is targeting a New Year's Day start to the 2020-21 season, which would be 3 months later than the start to 2019-20 on October 2nd. So, you know, probably the season will be compacted to some amount, but you see that clearly the it seems very likely that the 2021-22 season will not start as normally scheduled. Although,
I mean, there's no 2020/2021 season. It's 2021 season now.
Yeah.
New Year's Day.
I gave up on that particular hill about the 1998-99 NBA season, which was none of it was played in 1998.
I mean, but you're saying that I think there's a very high likelihood that we end up with both the NHL and the NBA seasons where all of a sudden maybe they're part of 1 year.
I think it's more likely long term in the NBA. I think the NHL is happier where they are because they're not as directly competing probably with football as the NBA is.
Interesting, though. So that's been a day that the NHL has tried to own, right? New Year's Day?
Yep.
And they're honestly like, college football has left a bit of a void there. It used to be, we were growing up, New Year's Day was bowl games. And now New Year's Day, you look at it, and first off, it's actually one of the worst days of the year. Fucking hate it. I've always hated New Year's Day. But
Mrs. Fantasy Genius's birthday observed.
What do you mean? Observed?
Yeah.
Okay.
We take a day off for Mrs. Fantasy Genius's birthday, which is New Year's Eve.
But it's like this day signifies you're like, all right, you need to get your shit together. Everything that you've been putting off all of a sudden is coming to a head on this one day. Also, it's just like, hey, that break that you have from work/school/whatever. Oh, it's almost over. Have fun, motherfucker. It's now 2021. Also,
I mean, I can't wait until the count, like many people just want to get 2020 in the rearview mirror.
I don't even want to consider the things that could be happening in 2021.
Well, you know.
Let's just say the hellscape could get worse.
It's going to be a long month here.
But, so that's typically been a day that the NHL has tried to pick up some ownership of over this last decade. Do you think that would be the same in the NBA, where Christmas Day to them is, that's the NBA's new day?
Christmas Day doesn't sound realistic. It's just going to be too quick for them to start. The latest scuttle seems to be centered around MLK Day, which is the day that they have tried to own in the month of January. I don't know which day the Pelton cast is trying to own in the month of January. Depressing post-Seahawks playoff loss emergency pod day.
Okay, so the Pelton cast owns the day. It's not in the month of January, because why would you ever try to own a day in the month of January? But the Friday before the NFL season starts is we've been petitioning the mayor. I've sent a couple, again, left on red.
Oh, no.
Pelton Cast Day in the city of Seattle, Washington, the Friday before the NFL season starts. So come on, people!
The first Blue Friday is also Pelton Cast today.
Look, when we finally get Jenny Durkin out of office, the new mayor will have promised the Pelton Cast a Pelton Cast Day the Friday before the NFL season starts.
I don't even know who that potentially would be, but we'll see. I mean, I guess I can think of some candidates, but nobody's.
I've got messages out to Sham Swant, messages out to Nikita Oliver,
Lorena Gonzalez.
Been left on red by Lorena Gonzalez passed.
Oh no, tough break.
Oh my god.
Sounders news. A 3-1 victory on Saturday against the Vancouver Whitecaps after a slow start against the Whitecaps, kind of packing it in. The Sounders scored 3 goals in the early second half. Joao Paulo opened the scoring with a screamer from just outside the box that, as I tweeted, I was saying, no, don't shoot this, because it seemed like the kind of shot that was inevitably going to sail way over the goalpost, but instead he stuck it in. That was followed by an own goal on a Christian Roldan cross and a Raul Ruidíaz header off a corner kick. The Sounders conceded on a debatable PK awarded on a foul at the edge of the box to create some drama before Vancouver had midfielder Janiu Bikel red carded, and both teams kind of settled in for the 3-1 final.
They accepted their fate. They did the Bengals. Pretty much. They punted.
It wasn't quite that, but they pretty much did. The Sounders moved all alone into first place in the Western Conference with 27 points now that they've played as many matches as Portland in second. But Saturday did start a stretch of 6 matches in 20 days for the Sounders, who will have to navigate presumably that entire stretch without multiple players called up for international duty during next week's break, and then subsequently having to quarantine upon their return to Seattle.
We're doing quarantines? I literally did not even know that was a thing.
MLS is doing quarantine. So okay. Gustav Svensson.
This is not a nationally imposed thing.
No. I mean, it's not. I don't think it's even a state imposed thing.
So the MLS itself is doing these quarantines.
Yeah, and Gustav Svensson, who previously joined his national team, had to do this and missed a few matches because of it. The expectation is he's going to be called up for their UEFA Nations games. I have not seen an announcement of that officially yet, but we have seen that Raul Ruiz Diaz has been called up to the Peru national team and Javier Arriaga to the Ecuador national team for World Cup qualifying in CONMEBOL. The addition of Roman Torres should help cover for Arriaga in the back line, but the midfield depth will be tested, I think, with no Svensson, and then Jordan Morris probably having to play some forward in that stretch with Will Bruin as the only real alternative to him at forward.
Qualifying happening right now is just like, I just can't even.
Yes, I get it. It seems like so far away.
And not even that it's far away, just like,
the idea that we're playing international soccer matches, because CONCACAF definitely isn't.
Yeah, that and that World Cup is like, that's going to be in 2022?
Yes.
I mean, the hope would be that the world is normal by 2022, especially by summer 2022 for that World Cup. But it's just like, mentally, I cannot grasp that that is happening right now.
Fair. So that stretch continues Wednesday when the Sounders host Real Salt Lake. Sounders previously played Real Salt Lake in Salt Lake City and drew 2-2. And then on Sunday, they will be traveling to face LAFC on ESPN at 4 p.m. LAFC trying to avenge a pair of Sounders wins in Seattle since the restart by 3-1 and 3-0 finals. Lastly, in Sounders news, Todd and Tara Leiwicki joined the Sounders ownership group, reuniting Todd with the Sounders after he helped bring the team to Seattle in his former role as Seahawks CEO before eventually going on to serve in a similar role with the Kraken. Cool. Bringing him back to Seattle. OL Reign suffered a 4-1 loss Wednesday at the Portland Thorns. Christine Sinclair, the Canadian legend, with a hat trick to power the Thorns' home win. The Reign will have a chance to even the matchup on Saturday, hosting Portland in the first game at Cheney Stadium in 2020 at 5 p.m. in a match televised on Twitch. The Reign announced Thursday that they are playing for Black Future Co-op Fund in the Verizon Community Shield, which will be presented to the winner of the NWSL Fall Series. The winning team will earn $25,000 Verizon grant to their chosen community partner, with $15,000 for the team that finishes second and $10,000 for the team that finishes third. The Reign ownership group is also committing $15,000 to Black Future Co-op Fund, with an additional $10,000 to match Verizon's contribution if the Reign in fact finish first. All donations through All in Washington to the Black Future Co-op Fund will be matched dollar for dollar by Jeff Bezos as part of his donation to that charity. The Black Future Co-op Fund was chosen by Reign players as their designated community partner. And per the press release that the Reign put out, the Black Future Co-op Fund was launched in June 2020 to address the systemic racism and wealth inequality that has disproportionately affected the Black community for generations. The fund serves as a hub for efforts to combat poverty, build generational wealth, preserve Black culture, and celebrate the resilience of Washington's Black community. The Black Future Co-op Fund was founded by an alliance of Black leaders, including Andrea Calpain, CEO of Bird Bar Place, Tawina Nobles, CEO of Tacoma Urban League, Michelle Merriweather, CEO of the Urban League of Metropolitan Seattle, and Angela Jones, the CEO of Washington STEM.
Let's have Jeff Bezos just do way more than match those, especially irrelevant if they win or lose. How about?
I mean, this is all donations to All in Washington, I believe, that he's matching.
Okay.
Not specifically the Reign-related ones, as I understand it. UW football, the schedule is out. The Huskies will open the season on November 7th at Cal. Then they'll host Oregon State and Arizona, their lone South opponent on the current schedule, and then play Wazoo on the new traditional Black Friday date before hosting Stanford and wrapping up the North schedule with a trip to Eugene on December 12th.
I've been toying with the idea of boycotting this college football season.
That's understandable. It'd be tough for the podcast.
I mean, the reality is I'm probably not, but just how about this? I'm not toying with the idea of boycotting this college football season. I'm toying with the idea of boycotting every college football season. Literally the only – it's fun cheering for college football, and I really like the players. I like the tailgating and the camaraderie, but like the whole thing feels like such a fucking farce that we're going into, and it's really hard. Even I like somehow ended up watching some college football on Saturday, and it was one of the least satisfying experiences of watching football in general in my entire life. And I remember watching NFL Europe back in the day. But it's like it shouldn't be happening. The season should not be happening. These players should not be subjected to these games. And to me, the primary issue is that they shouldn't be playing during COVID. And it's just playing in the same sport as places, seeing that LSU is getting rid of CDC guidelines for entering their stadium for fans. I don't know what percentage of the stadium is full of fans or whatever. I know that the Attorney General of Louisiana blamed a loss a couple of weeks ago against Mike Leach's Mississippi State team on having guidelines for fans entering the stadium. And it's like, you can't play on the same field. You can't play the same sport as these people, right? Who are, because of this sport happening, people are going to die. And that to me is just like, it is so hard to move past that, that like the UW is not going to be doing that, but they are still playing on a level playing field in a lot of ways with universities that are doing this, who are succumbing to peer pressure from these far right politicians who are saying things that are going to lead to people dying. And that is not what this is about. Like, the entire point of this sport is that it should be fun, right? Like, this shouldn't be a fucking serious thing. We shouldn't be considering that people are going to die from college football games happening. But this is a thing I have to think about now. And that's why it's just like, it is so difficult to even try to pay attention to these games.
But we have literally learned that it doesn't matter what the Pac-12 does. Literally, that happened. The Pac-12 stopped playing. Didn't know whether we were going to play at all, and it didn't fucking affect anything else.
No, the Pac-12 does not matter with regards to college football.
If they can play with a reasonable level of safety, and there's not certainty.
Who's they? Pac-12 or the SEC?
Pac-12.
Okay, I was going to say, because there's no safety. Seeing those photos of Georgia over the weekend was like, God's
what year are we in?
It is shocking.
But, I mean, one thing we've learned with the Titans outbreak in the NFL is just and plausibly with the White House outbreak, although I'm a little less more skeptical of their level of testing than I am of the NFL Tennessee Titans, which is an amazing thing to say. We have learned that daily testing alone is not sufficient to prevent the spread of COVID. Like, there's too much possibility of a false negative or people being infectious before they test positive, all of those factors. So even the players in the Pac-12, even though they're taking, I think, less of a risk than players in the SEC or some of these other conferences. So there's some level of risk that these players are taking on. And I hope that they're going in with eyes wide open. We've seen a number of players opting back into the Pac-12 season recently. So, there is excitement about playing from the players, but, know, I hope that, especially if you look at these outbreaks that are occurring near college's campuses, we've seen UW's Greek Row have a second outbreak that is leading to an increase in spreading King County as a whole after, you know, rates has been declining here. So hope everyone continues to stay as safe as possible.
If the outbreaks are limited to the players or whatever, I think we all know we can go into it fairly confident that most players will be healthy.
Yes.
Even if they contract coronavirus. Like, I'm not that worried about the health and safety of the individual players. Also, like, they have chosen to play a very dangerous game. So the hope is that they're isolated. The reality is, even with testing, like you mentioned, it is highly likely that you are contagious before you're symptomatic, and even before you would get a positive test. And I think that's the issue that's showing up in a lot of places, is there are people who are getting into the facility who are both positive without you knowing, testing-wise, and are contagious, and that it's going to spread throughout multiple people. Like, I don't want to say it's going to be everywhere, because I don't think that's likely, but it'll happen somewhere. And I just hope that these institutions, and I have more faith in these particular institutions than I do almost any institutions throughout the country, that they will do this as responsibly as possible. I do not think UW is Notre Dame. You know, they are not a despicable institution with regards to the health of their players and their faculty and students. But it's just, there's a high likelihood that players could get sick during the season. And we don't know what that means. And also, like, we don't really have an explanation for why it's happening, other than, as we've discussed, they're trying to keep up with these other conferences that are just going to do it no matter what, that do not care.
Well, I mean, I think we have some explanations. There are financial explanations, and the players do have, you know, less urgently in the Pac-12 than in the Big Ten, made it clear that they want to play despite the risks. But one of the things, you know, we sometimes do with young people is, like, put rules in place because of the fact that we know that when you're that age, you may have a difficulty understanding the long-term ramifications of decisions you make. So, you know, that's why there have to be adults in the room. What?
We're also talking about the sport of football, so.
Right.
Which is, like, the very definition of maybe making decisions that in the short term don't seem that negative, and in the long term do seem that negative. Anyway, I've just been toying with the idea. The reality is I probably will pay attention. And if we want to talk about the schedule, UW faces a pretty favorable schedule.
I mean, there weren't that many variables to the schedule, like where they were going to play and who they were going to play, like when they were going to play. I probably would have preferred having the Wazoo game at the end of the season, the Apple Cup at the end of the season, instead of on the same date as normal. But what are you going to do? I mean, it's not like I'm upset about it. There's so many other variables this year.
I'm going to say a positive from a hanging out and watching football perspective. Give me my September and October Saturdays, and I don't care after that. Like, a Saturday in September and October is a sacred day. By the time you get to November, like, you can punt every fucking day in Seattle, right? But, like, if I get a Saturday in September or October, that is a great day to go out into the world and live your life and not have to pay attention to college football. Maybe this should be permanent.
Well, don't go out into the world. Just, you know.
But no, you could go into the world. You could go into the woods. Look, we live in the most beautiful place on earth. Right. Like, you could go into you could go to see mountains, woods, water, beaches. Like, every one of those things is available to you on Saturdays in September.
How many of those things have you been doing on Saturdays?
Dog, every single one of those places.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I do a marathon of all of them. I swim to Vashon. But
you're doing a triathlon?
What I'm saying is that it's just having your Saturdays in September and October feels very nice. And by the time you get to November, you're just like, I don't, whatever.
I want to be indoors all the time.
Yeah, every day feels the same. Just fucking the rain can pour on me. Give me what you got, world. So, like, for this year, I love the schedule.
Yep.
All right. Well, anyway.
All right, quickly, we're going to remember a couple of games as we move ahead in the 2000 season that we're remembering to try to get through it before the 2020 season starts. So games 7 and 8 for the Huskies at Arizona State and then home versus Cal. Arizona State was in the 8th and final season with Bruce Snyder as coach after his 5 seasons at Cal. Their notable stars included freshman Terrell Suggs, Todd Heap, and Adam Archuleta. ASU entered the game.
Stars.
Yeah. Entered the game 4-1 with their quarterbacking play was not so strong. Entered the game 4-1 without a marquee win. Both teams had 6 turnovers in that game in Tempe, including a combined 9 lost fumbles. A blocked punt and fumble set up the Huskies' first 2 TDs as they led 14-6 early in the fourth quarter. ASU then made it 14-13 before Rich Alexis' 86-yard touchdown more or less put the game away. With a brief scare after the Huskies were called for holding in the end zone on a punt for a safety to produce the 21-15 final.
Was weather a factor in that game?
I mean, it was probably hot.
There's no other reason why they fumbled that many times?
Just football was much more turnover prone in 2000, as it turns out.
Okay.
Cal entered the game Husky game 2-4, having upset number 13 UCLA the previous Saturday for their first conference win. Sophomore quarterback Kyle Bowler was in his second season as a starter, while sophomore Nnamdi Asamoah was establishing himself on the other side of the football. Let's see. Did I not put in here how long UW had won consecutively versus Cal? I thought I had that note. Here it is. UW trailed Cal 24-13 entering the fourth quarter, putting the 18-game winning streak over the Bears in jeopardy. But 4 consecutive Cal turnovers, including a blocked punt in UW territory, set up 23 unanswered points for the Huskies in the fourth quarter to win by a comfortable-looking 36-24 margin. As for those teams, the rest of the season, Arizona State beat Arizona in the Territorial Cup to reach the Aloha Classic, where they lost to Boston College, having nearly upset Oregon in a 56-55 loss 2 weeks later. Cal would win at USC the following week, but lose their final 3 games by 8 points or fewer to finish 3-8.
And I was going to say that turned out to be a pretty good Cal team, but I think under Bowler, they were never that good. It wasn't until the Jeff Tedford, Aaron Rodgers era.
Well, no, his senior year was when Tedford came in, and Bowler, that's when he established himself as a first-round pick. And that also, I'm pretty sure, I think UW won in Berkeley the next year. So I think it was the year after that Cal snapped the 20-game winning streak in a game I attended.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
In Cal?
No, in Seattle.
In Seattle.
At Husky State.
Who, with Rodgers or Bowler?
Bowler.
Huh.
But Asamoah had a huge game.
It's funny because I was thinking of that. When do I first remember hearing about Nnamdi Asamoah? And it definitely was when he was a Raider. Like, I don't remember him. I remember Kyle Bowler pre-draft with the throwing from his knees from the 50-yard line, of course.
Correct.
But, like, I definitely do not remember hearing anything about Nnamdi Asamoah until he was established in the NFL. But, like, I have a specific memory of how much
he fucked shit up.
Do you have any recollection of either of these games?
Zero.
No.
I think I'm confusing the Cal. There's a Cal game I remember that it was our mom's one of her like high school reunions.
Oh.
And they were staying at a hotel in Tequila.
Yes. When they were got wasted. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was one of those games.
That was an experience, but I think that would have been the 99 season, as it turns out, not the 2000 season.
That was in the
season.
Fall? Wow, I remember that being in the spring.
Because that would have been her 30th anniversary at that point.
Huh. So. All right. Well, I mean, a lot of big names in the NFL up there, between Terrell Suggs, Todd Heap, Adam Archuleta, and Kyle Bowler, and Nnamdi Asamoah, but this was a Cal team that was really on the brink of turning into something pretty special for a period, a few years later. It was interesting seeing when I started going to UW games, Cal was the class of the Pac-12 or up there with the class of the Pac-12.
I think USC was the class. They had this guy named Pete Carroll as their coach.
Yes. I it was the class of the Pac-12 was USC, Oregon, and Cal, which it seems like they really had never reached those heights before or after, but they had this short window of time where Cal was one of the most feared teams in the Pac-12.
There you go. I mean, Cal's still feared by UW the last few years. Let's wrap up with the Seahawks, who got to 4-0 with a 31-23 win on Sunday at the Miami Dolphins.
I just saw your forecast.
It's the second time in franchise history that they have started 4-0, joining the 2013 season when, you'll recall, they became Super Bowl 48 champions. The Seahawks have never started 5-0 in franchise history because they lost at Indianapolis the following week.
Oh, I'm still not over it.
Still not over the Andrew Luck Russell Wilson debate, which I feel like it's been settled now. I feel like Russ won that one.
Yeah, you know, Luck's an MVP candidate this year. Can I ask you a question about the greatest? The conversation you were saying about Bob Condotta earlier about the player who was playing the greatest in Seattle sports history. Are we just forgetting second half 2015 Thomas Rawls?
I thought you were going to say second half 2015 Russ. I mean.
No. Obviously. It was a joke.
I get it.
Yeah. Okay. Do I have to explain it to you? See, I was setting it up. Russ then. It was Russ then playing worse than Russ now is playing?
I mean, I'd have to dig into the numbers to really analyze that. I don't know. They're both really fucking awesome.
It's all the same Russell Wilson. That's the thing to me. Like, I don't think that Russell Wilson has gotten better as a quarterback. He's basically been the same quarterback, except for the year that I called him the 8th to 12th best quarterback in the NFL, which he was
coming off injuries, right?
He got injured in the first game.
Yeah.
Namakansu injured him, and he just didn't have a great year. But aside from that, Russell Wilson has just been awesome forever. Like, this... I feel like when we see this conversation about him being an MVP candidate, it's like, yeah, Russell Wilson's great right now, but also he was great last year and the year before that and the year before that. Like, he's been this great the entire time. Y'all motherfuckers just didn't notice.
I mean, the offense wasn't letting him be great for part of that period.
But do you... Okay, so you're going to dig into 2015. Okay, so they've never started out 5-0 in the history of the Seattle Seahawks.
That is correct. So a chance for history on Sunday. I mean, we should talk about like Ben Baldwin's victory lap for the Let Russ Cook movement.
Well, I guess the nerds. Twitter's the best offensive coordinator there is. Can you imagine being upset about what is happening both in Seattle and throughout the NFL right now? Like, you just have to be playing yourself. If
I can imagine being unhappy with, like, preferring a more defensive style of game. I can imagine that. I can't imagine thinking it's wrong. That's what you're saying.
That's the point. But, like, also the most exciting, this is the part that really chaps my ass, is the most exciting play in sports in general, but Seahawks football in particular, is when Russ is throwing a deep ball, like, you feel it inside of you. There's never a moment when he hands it off to DJ Dallas that you're like, oh my God, right? Like, that is, it's just, it is not fun. Deep passes, when you're outside playing football with your friends, you want to throw the ball downfield because it's fun, right?
I mean, like, this is, I think, a lot of the reason why people resist it is because of the fact that there's an idea, well, if something is fun, it must also be bad.
This isn't baseball, dog. Like, baseball is bad and it's boring.
I don't know who you're arguing with here. I'm not the person to argue. I don't know if you're aware of this. I'm kind of interested in statistical analysis myself.
But this notion that, seeing that tweet that was like, well, I guess Twitter's the best offensive coordinator in the NFL. It's like, yeah, motherfucker, because Twitter keeps being right and offensive coordinators keep adjusting because of Twitter and old school perspectives keep going away. Teams are now going for two down 14 when they score a touchdown in the fourth quarter. That's happening. teams are passing the ball. The Seahawks are passing the ball on first down now. Like, the whole world is changing around you, and you want a two-yard run? Like, what is – why do you pay attention to the sport if what you want the most out of the sport is the least interesting thing from the sport? Throwing a football as far as you can and somebody catching it, leaping through the air like a goddamn Adonis and DK Metcalf and catching that football is the is the reason we pay attention to football. If football didn't have the forward pass, if football was just a scrum, we wouldn't watch it.
I mean, probably not, but that's a subjective thing. I'm not going to be upset at someone who wants a different style of football.
There's no subjective thing. The NFL is moving in one direction and one direction only, objectively. You can look at the numbers and look where the NFL is moving.
Sure, but that doesn't what you like to see in football is not
okay,
an objective thing.
But I'm saying the idea that being like, well, I guess the nerds think they're right all the time. These guys over here, like, that's what this perspective is like.
I don't know what this tweet even was that you saw that you think is like representative of an entire worldview. This one fucking tweet.
I'm not saying it's representative of an entire worldview. I'm saying that this is a perspective that people have, and I'm fucking sick of it.
It's a perspective that one person you saw on Twitter has. Sure. Okay.
Love to go on a very long bossa nova where we scream at each other. So anyway,
that's
Damon
not this
Harrison
podcast.
Came in for a visit today. That's an interesting proposition if that would happen.
Does sound like you're going to sign Michael Kendricks, which is probably an upgrade because Cody Bard was not great on Sunday.
Yes. Sobering news.
But the good news was no new injuries for the Seahawks coming out of Sunday's game. After a scare when Chris Carson was down, seemed like he was in concussion protocol, but apparently I guess he just not had the wind knocked out of him.
Wait, I have to keep holding the bit for a second. It's a dangerous sport. You can make it out of any particular week safe. Then I think we have to have a victory, win or lose, in the ball game.
The ball game? I don't know why a neutral guy would call it a ball game.
Down to number 6 in DVOA.
Yeah. Seahawks dropped a couple spots.
Another loss.
Even with the win in Miami. They're 3rd in offense.
But on the no new injuries, you can be in concussion protocol and not have a concussion.
Correct, but it does not appear that he even was checked for a concussion, I guess.
Safe way to approach a dangerous sport.
There was some debate on that on the podcast. But, or
on
the broadcast,
what podcast?
I should say.
We're all on
the podcast. The broadcast.
But Dick Stockton, there is some debate about a lot of things for Dick Stockton. Whether Xavier Howard was Xavier Howard, whether the pass was intercepted or broken up. There was a lot of debate about a lot of things with Dick Stockton and Brady Quinn on that broadcast, but nevertheless. So the Seahawks.
I thought it was cool that Brady Quinn mentioned that the Seahawks practice goal line situation. It's like end of half situation so much. Then Pete Carroll did bring that up on Monday on the Pete Carroll show.
Really? I mean, yeah. Look, if we want to talk about, we haven't summarized this game at all. A couple of key moments. I mean, obviously, the play of Ryan Neal has been pretty impressive.
Yes.
Ugh. Dynamite.
He's playing a little bit on the edge. Podcasting school is sure paying off.
I can't even remember what I was going to say after
that. I mean, the Seahawks defense wasn't good over the course of this game, but it was timely in terms of, you know, stiffening in the red zone, forcing Miami to settle for field goals, and coming up with a few key turnovers. And if you have an offense that's going as well as the Seahawks offense is going, that's all you need.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was the best game that the defense played. Again, the turnovers were a huge part of it. Like, they had the breakdown at the very end. We knew it was coming, and it came. But that's fine. Like, I don't look at this game as a failure, per se. The injuries coming out of that game with no injuries was huge. But to me, the most important part of the game was we have another week of passing on first down. And I don't have
to passing on second and long.
I don't have the number on the top of my head, but I think Russ was 15 of 16 for like 189 yards passing on first down, which is just ridiculous. Like, Russell Wilson passing on first down is the most dangerous thing in the entire sport of football. And then also passing...
Actually, playing during a pandemic is the most dangerous thing in the entire sport of football.
Look, being there at all for Dick Stockton was not advisable. The passing at the end of the half, though, I think that is one moment where, like, the Seahawks won that game because of the pass to David Moore and then the touchdown that eventually happened to Travis Homer on that pass. But working to score a touchdown in, I mean, how much time did they get the ball back with?
29 seconds.
29 seconds. And there was no
give up. Scored with 6 seconds left. I mean, I would have been okay with the draw there. The draw actually is pretty successful. It's not a give up draw. It's a see what we can get draw.
But
yeah.
But I, you know what works a lot better than, I can't remember the first down play. But
I think it was second down, the Moore pass. Yes, I think the first
the Moore
down
pass
was
a... But they picked up huge yardage on first down too, the first play.
I don't know if it was huge yardage. It was yardage.
Hold on. We need to go.
I've got it here. Okay. All right. The first down pass was a 11-yard completion to Greg Olsen.
And he got out of bounds, I believe.
No, they took the timeout.
Oh, okay. So they had two timeouts.
They had two timeouts. Yes.
Yeah, but so like they came out and they were like, we're going for it. And that is, look, this is Big Balls Pete being back, right? Like, we're seeing a different era of Pete Carroll here.
He did it after they unsuccessfully went for a fourth down earlier in the game.
Oh, my God. And I feel like we're just like, we're always so sensitive about the Seahawks. We're like, they didn't pick up that fourth down after, so the Dolphins declined the penalty that would have made it 3rd and 13, and said the Seahawks go for a 4th and 3, and they end up not picking up, Russ gets sacked, and it's like, hell yeah, Pete. Like, look, sometimes this isn't going to work, but the part of being aggressive isn't – it's going to work every single time because nothing is going to work every single time. Being conservative isn't going to work every single time. Being aggressive isn't going to work every single time. It's about playing statistical odds. And when they went for that 4th and 3, it was like, the Seahawks are going for it. Like, this is a different Seahawks offense. This is a different Pete Carroll who's there. This is a different Skybox Shoddy. I mean, wait. This is a different Brian Schottenheimer. It's the same Skybox Shoddy. But, like, that was a totally different team on the field on Sunday. Even though this felt like a Seahawks game in a lot of ways, the perspective was totally different than it's been in the past. And then also, you just have to mention DK Metcalf and his yards per catch, which is ridiculous.
He had in this game 4 catches for 106 yards. That's 26.5 yards per catch.
I mean, he has one more reception on the season than Chris Carson has, and has almost 300 more receiving yards on the season than Chris Carson. Like, it is ridiculous. He has 100 more receiving yards than Tyler Lockett on 10 less catches. Like, the DK Metcalf has entered like a different world as a receiver. These are numbers that have previously been reserved for like Randy Boss.
I don't know if I go that far.
I mean, he's got through 4 games, he's averaging over 100 yards per game. He's averaging almost a touchdown per game. And he's doing it on so few catches. Like, what DK Metcalf is doing at 23 years old is a beautiful thing to watch.
It is. I agree. And, you know, you mentioned his couple of big plays in this game, but David Moore's development has been pretty awesome to see. Like, you know, Freddie Swain couldn't come down with that pass in the touchdown in the end zone for a touchdown, but just came down out of bounds. But, you know, the Seahawks,
by the way, is Freddie Swain's first target that was incomplete all season.
Really?
He has 6 targets and 5 receptions. You don't even realize that because all Freddie Swain does is get first downs.
The Seahawks have gotten competent receiver play from their secondary options. They still played. This was the first time Tyler Lockett and TDK Metcalf were both under 90% of snaps last week. Not by much, but they were under. But they've gotten competent play from their depth wide receivers despite not having Philip Dorsett and not having hopefully at some point, God willing, free Josh Gordon.
Flash. But also, like, the drops that... I mean, Tyler Lockett had maybe the worst drop we've ever seen of his entire career.
I mean, that might be recency bias, but it wasn't great.
Not the magnitude wasn't that great, but, like, the ball was in his arm.
Yeah, no, Yeah, I'm just saying it's probably happened before, and we just, you know, don't remember the 2017 season that clearly now.
I mean, he's got four drops, and DK has three drops on the air, where, like, Russ just doesn't have that many incompletions. So, I don't know. It was a fun game to watch. To me, I had nerves at various times throughout the game, but the drive and the touchdown to Homer at the end of the half was like, okay, like, This feels good. And then Shaq Griffin also playing like the, I know the secondary hasn't been great, but Shaquille Griffin, sorry, I should specify that now. Shaquille Griffin is playing at a very high level this year.
To me, the more important part of this game was the drive that was finished with the David Moore touchdown that got the lead to 9 points. 'Cause that was when I was able to like start to put more attention on game two of the WNBA finals that was occurring simultaneously to that.
This was after the Shaq Griffin interception though.
I can't, was the Carson touchdown after the Shaq Griffin interception? 'Cause they scored twice within a minute and a half. So I think that was probably post interception.
Carson touchdown?
Yes. Yes. That was the pass to DK to the one.
I thought that was a DK touchdown. Okay, that makes sense. Yes. And that's what put them up 16.
Yes.
And then that ended the game.
Then you felt really comfortable about things.
Yeah. I mean, a great game. A game that, you know, Chris Carson, I don't want to say that running backs matter, but he looks different than DJ Dallas and Travis Homer do when he's running the ball. You feel more comfortable with Carson running it.
Oh, 100%. I'm very into Travis Homer as a third down back and a 2-minute drill back. I'm not as into him as a conventional running back. DJ Dallas, we'll see. 2 carries for 8 yards. We'll see.
Yeah, no, I don't. I mean, Homer didn't have a great game, but like it felt like there was a difference between Carson and the younger Miami backs in this game. And so happy to see that he was healthy coming out of it, that play wasn't a big deal, and that he was able to even play in the game at all. So tell us about the Vikings Sunday night football.
Yeah, the Vikings coming off their first win on Sunday, a 31-24 victory in Houston that got Bill O'Brien fired. They led by 2 touchdowns in the fourth quarter before hanging on to win. The Texans reached the Minnesota 1 with 1:26 left before the Vikings defense stopped to David Johnson. Deshaun Watson muffed a snap, and then Watson was incomplete from the 5 on fourth down. After a slow start offensively, aside from the fourth quarter of their opening loss in Green Bay when they scored 24 of their 34 points, the Vikings have opened up their offense since first-round pick Justin Jefferson replaced BC Johnson opposite Adam Thielen at wide receiver. Jefferson has played nearly 80% of their snaps the last 2 weeks, combining for 11 catches on 14 targets and 278 yards with a touchdown in the Stephon Diggs role. As noted by Nick Olson on Twitter, Jefferson and Thielen are currently the top 2 rated wide receivers by Pro Football Focus, and Jefferson is number 2 in DR, where Thielen is only 20th.
Wow! That is incredible! Especially considering how little they've passed the ball.
Yes, the Vikings rank as the run-heaviest team versus expectation in Ben Baldwin's model, with the Seahawks now the pass-heaviest team.
There we go! There was a time 2 years ago where it was like Vikings, Seahawks, Vikings, Seahawks. Who's going to run the ball more? There's a game where
the Spider-Man meme.
I swear to God, Mike Zimmer passed the ball under 10 times in a game. And Mike Zimmer has not changed his perspective. And meanwhile, Pete Carroll is like Dr. Manhattan, who has left Earth during this time period. Look, you don't get the reference. I'll explain it to you later. You'll watch it in 10 years.
We'll see. I mean, the Vikings have been running the ball quite well. Delvin Cook is averaging 5.7 yards per carry and has combined for 311 yards the last 2 weeks. After signing a big extension during the training camp, he is number one in the NFL and Football Outsiders DR metric. Backup Alexander Mattison, also a threat, which is why you're keeping him on your fantasy team.
I actually dropped him. It does not matter whether he's a threat. He's on my fantasy team because he's Dalvin Cook's backup.
I know. So why have the Vikings struggled so much in this 1-3 start? The common explanation would be that they lost both starting cornerbacks. They waived Xavier Rhodes and lost Trey Waynes to free agency. They're currently last week starting rookie cornerbacks Jeff Gladley, the number 131 pick of last year of the 2020 draft, and third rounder Cameron Dantzler, with 2018 first rounder Mike Hughes sidelined the last 2 weeks. They also lost linebacker Anthony Barr to a torn pec suffered in week two. But they have actually been better in defensive DVOA, where they rank 13th, than offense, where they rank 16th, and 9th in pass defense. Their pass offense ranks 24th because Cousins has the third highest sack rate among qualified players. Only Carson Wentz and Nick Mullins, or I'm sorry, only Lamar Jackson and Deshaun Watson higher in sack rate. It's, you know, typically scrambling quarterbacks tend to take more sacks. And then a 6% interception rate is easily the highest among qualified players this season. That's where Carson Wentz and Nick Mullins are the only others above 4%. So that's odd because Cousins last year was one of the lower interception QBs in the NFL, throwing as many in all of 2019 as he has in 2020 so far.
These Vikings numbers are just like they're indecipherable. You say that they are the 13th best defense per DVOA, and you look at it and you're like, they have given up 522 yards, 354 yards, 444 yards, and 386 yards. They have given up 43 points, 28 points, 31 points, and 23 points. Like, they're basically averaging 30 points against a game. How could this possibly be the case? Like, there is a disconnect between DVOA and what is actually happening on the field.
I mean, some of it is just like the standard for defense is a lot different than it used to be.
And I think that's part of it, where it's like to rank as the number 13th defense is like you might be giving up 30. What that reads as, not great for the Vikings. If you're going to be the number 13 defense and give up 30 points a game, you're going to be able to have to keep up with the Seahawks offense that is significantly better.
Well, the Vikings have a defense on Sunday, which, by the way, it's the third consecutive year these teams have played in prime time. They played on Monday night each of the last 2 years. The Seahawks emerging victorious.
They just came on prime time.
They do. I don't know why. And that thing... it's called rain. For the first time, we worried about the thunderstorms in Miami. They never came for whatever reason. For the first time in the Seattle Seahawks 2020 season, Russell Wilson will almost certainly be touched by rain. The forecast calls for a half inch of rain on Sunday and rain pretty much all day.
I just scattered thunder showers too.
I mean, the one thing that can prevent Russ from cooking is one of his fire... it's rained out.
I'm just going to throw this out there. I said this last week, in fact, to you about the Seahawks defense, was I do not accept that this defense is that bad, and they had a better game. I also cannot accept that rain unto itself can stop Russ from cooking. I think that Russ has...
It's just rain and the Arizona Cardinals?
That's a big issue. Now, it's true, though. Russ has really not faced rain in a scenario where he's been cooking.
I mean, the question is which direction the causation goes there, I guess. Is he cooking because of the fact that he's enjoying good weather?
Never
or...
let to cook before this and the second half of 2015. Like, it'll be an interesting scenario. A lot of people were nervous about, so there was the comparison between the Seahawks offense 2020 and the Cowboys offense 2019. And the Seahawks offense through week four seems to have continued to cook. Now we have another hurdle to cross, and that is rain. Can Russ...
especially because the Vikings have been worse in terms of their rush defense than their pass defense, despite what I told you about their inexperience in the secondary. Like, they are last in run-stop win rate, according to ESPN's metric. So, do the Seahawks see this as an opportunity where we're going to get back to what we do in terms of running the football?
I don't see that as a difference in letting Russ cook. If it's successful, do it. that to me is the main thing, where it's like, and also I think that the stats are lying to us a little bit about this Vikings team. I don't think the Vikings are bad. I don't think they're a 1-3 team necessarily, but I do not think they are the 13th best defense in the NFL. Like, nothing about these numbers suggests to me that they are the 13th best defense in the NFL, and nothing about these numbers suggests to me that they can slow down the Seahawks offense.
I wish I were that optimistic, but I've watched the Seahawks play in the rain before.
Do you know that they gave up 444 yards to the Titans? Like,
oh,
386 to the Texans, who just fired their coach after? Like,
I mean, I don't think the yardage total matters that much in that Houston game. I mean, the fact that Houston drove for, you know, what could have been would have put them in position to go for the tying 2-point conversion is a factor, but yeah, I don't think you can just look at raw yardage in 2020.
I suppose so, but like, there's nothing about this Vikings team that suggests to me that they are a good defense. They gave up 364 yard passing yards to the Packers. Like, Aaron Rodgers did whatever he wanted, and as little as we want to admit it, the Packers are probably the most similar offense to the Seahawks that they've faced so far.
Probably, yeah.
I mean, I listened to that Colts game on the radio, and the Colts were pounding the fucking rock against the Vikings. Like, it was not, and they were doing it successfully, granted, but like, the approach that the Colts have had is not going to be similar to the approach that the Seahawks have. The Seahawks are a passing team now. Kirk Cousins 2 years ago numbers. This isn't Russell Wilson 2 years ago numbers. The Seahawks are passing the ball on a first down. They are going to push this Vikings defense to a place that they have not seen since the Packers in week one, and the Vikings cannot win this game. You cannot fight passing with running. Those two things are not comparable. Dalvin Cook is averaging how many yards per carry? You got me.
5.7.
How many fucking yards per pass is Russell Wilson averaging?
I don't have that handy, but it's a lot more than 5.7.
Yeah. A good, literally the best running back in the NFL is not comparable to the best quarterback in the NFL.
It's not comparable to an average quarterback. I agree with that. I mean, Minnesota, by the way, is averaging, allowing 8 net yards per pass attempt, which puts them third worst in the NFL, slightly ahead of the Seahawks and fourth worst, and behind the Miami Dolphins.
Okay. What else do you need?
Dry weather?
So the...
A dome?
What you're saying to me is that the only reason you're nervous is because of... It's like being worried about Bigfoot stomping on the field. Weather? That's it? You think
if Bigfoot stomped on the field like 2 to 3 times a year, then yeah, I'd be really concerned about it.
No, this is conspiracy theorizing. Like,
it's not conspiracy theorizing.
That's what you're telling me. I'm looking at
We studied the data on Russ in the Rain.
No, you studied the data on past Russ in the Rain. This is different.
Okay.
You're going to be condescending about this again? How many fucking times throughout the year are you going to be condescending about the Seahawks offense before you start realizing that it's good?
I'm fully emotionally guarded. Let me put it that way.
Russ is at 9.4 yards per attempt. Like, this is a greater... Do you need me to do... You know about math, right? Which number is greater, 9.4 or 5.2?
I'm well aware.
What do you want more of? Look, Chris Carson's averaging 4.5 yards per carry. It's not that far off from Dalvin Cook's pace.
I mean, I'm not disputing that. I think that Chris Carson is going to carry the ball a lot on Sunday, and I think that probably will be successful for the Seahawks.
There's nothing the Vikings can do to account for the Seahawks offense in this game. I don't mean to be blindly optimistic, but I'm looking at this as a 1-3 team coming in here who really hasn't stopped anybody either on the ground or through the air. And I don't know what the means are for the Vikings. What is the avenue? Like, literally, what is the game plan to win this game? They wear
well, Justin Jefferson and Adam Thielen both have over 100 yards against the Seahawks secondary.
Do you think that they are capable of if Justin Jefferson and Adam Thielen both have 100 yards, they are down the entire game. Like, do you know the Vikings? No, if both of those receivers have over 100 yards, the Seahawks are up end to end.
I get what you're saying, but I think that they can have a lot of big plays.
Mike Zimmer is a dumb coach. He's coaching a team from 10 years ago.
I would not go that far.
How far would you go?
I would say that, I mean, he's making regressive choices in terms of passing and running.
Okay,
but
whatever.
He's also got a team that lost its entire secondary and has it ninth in pass defense DVOA because that's his specialty.
He's
not unlike one Peter Clay Carroll.
Not utilizing his strengths. They don't really have a good defense. Like, look, if you actually could do this defense and control the ball thing, do it. Sure, great, whatever. But they're 1-3. I don't know if you've noticed that.
You seem overly concerned about their record. I mean, most of these games have been close. They lost by 1 point to the Vikings. If they had beaten the Vikings, they had scored an extra field goal. I'm sorry, the Titans. Would you feel that differently about them because they were 2-2?
Not really. I mean, they got throttled by the Colts. Kirk Cousins threw for 113 yards. Kirk Cousins has not thrown
really
for 300 yards in a game this year. And you're telling me that Adam Thielen and Justin Jefferson are both going to have 100 yards in this game? Like, who do you think is walking through that door?
Oh, who I think is walking through that door is Ryan Neal. I mean, with all due respect.
Ryan Neal? Is who you're talking about? Trey Flowers. Sure, give me that. Whatever. Ryan Neal. Per PFR is like a top 10 DB this year. Don't give me Ryan Neal.
PFF, I assume you mean. PFR does not have overall rankings.
PFF, sure. Yeah, Pro Football Reference. I'm just saying, they don't pass the ball. That is not what this team does. They're playing an antiquated form of offense. If the Seahawks score in 5 seconds, what are they going to do? Drive 65 yards and kick a field goal? This is a team that scored in 23 seconds last week. This is a different
They're not. Stock. This is the rain. You are not getting this.
That's all you're concerned with. That's all you're
saying. Yes!
Weather. Literally, like, you're citing the gods raining down upon this game. I'm talking about facts.
Russell Wilson's record in the rain versus in when the weather is clear in Seattle is a fact.
Russell Wilson's record when he has been let cook is 4-0.
What I love about it is that you're never going to see it coming. You're going to be so blindsided by it, whereas I am emotionally protected and guarded against it.
That's
when it eventually happens.
Every week,
I can say that every
week.
You
sound like a Vikings fan, dude. Like. This is
you know what I sound like? I sound like a Seahawks fan anywhere before the last 4 weeks. Do you remember the Cardinals game?
No, this was a good team. The Seahawks have been a good team for like 8 years because they have Russell Wilson. Am I confused? Look, Cliff
and they've never lost a home
door.
Game to a lesser
Bruce
foe
Arians
in that time?
Walking through that door. This isn't a Cardinals game in December. This is a Vikings game in October. It's different.
All right, so your chances of victory are 100% again? Look, you already called the storm we're going to win the championship, and you're petulant.
I told you. I told you. We were on the phone, and I was like, they're going to sweep easy. We all knew it was up. Come on. I think their chances of winning this game are like 82%. They're 7.5-point favorites. Literally, your only concern with this is that it's going to rain.
My only concern is the thing that has caused the Seahawks to play poorly on offense many, many
also,
times.
They're good
in the
at run defense.
Especially if they get snacks.
Well, he's not playing this week.
What do you mean?
You think he's going to sign by like Wednesday and just play?
Yeah. Why else would you sign him?
To play him the remaining weeks? The Seahawks currently
I mean,
rank 6th in rush defense.
Why do you think they promoted Ryan Neal from the practice squad, you know, 2 weeks ago on Friday? Was it because of the fact that they were looking for him in future weeks?
You can promote players from the practice squad every week, too. The Seahawks currently rank 6th in rush defense and 29th in pass defense. And you think Mike Zimmer is sitting there being like, you know what? We have Dalvin Cook and Alexander Mattison. I only run the ball and have never pivoted once in my entire life. But you know what? This is the week. He is a one-dimensional coach.
People said that about Pete Carroll before this.
No, they didn't! Nobody.
I mean, I don't know if you're aware of this. There was a big debate about whether they should fire him. You seem to have missed that. Your memory lasts about 4 weeks, as far as I can tell.
It's going to last 5 weeks after this week. And then you're going to be telling, who do the Seahawks play next week? Bye? You're going to be like, look, pretty cloudy.
Well, probably is going to be. I don't
think can't guarantee
could
that
mar their practices.
Bye. Like, I don't know what you need from this team to understand that things are different. How many weeks do you need this?
At least 8. We're talking about 2 seasons of it.
I have Buffalo week 9 circled. That'll be the last game. That's the one. So week 10, right?
Yes.
Yeah, week 10 at the Rams. That's the week that you're going to believe that this offense is real. Kirk Cousins has not thrown for 300 yards this year. They do not have an offense that, wow, DK Metcalf's the high receiver every game for the Seahawks. Incredible. They don't have an offense that is catered to play against this team. Like, there's not, you basically need to be perfect to play against the Seahawks team.
Amazing how perfect the Arizona Cardinals were last December.
You can't cite Cardinals games. B, we're not really even citing last year. Can you not see the difference between this season and last season? Look, they beat the fucking Bengals 2019 in week 1 last year. There is a difference between these teams. Also, the Seahawks have played a pretty hard schedule, which I suppose the Vikings have also, but you really, really do not believe this. Is this an emotional self-preservation thing? Or do you...
Yeah.
You're...
That's a little from column A and a little from column B.
I mean, I think that the Vikings have played 3 teams who almost certainly will make the playoffs, and then the Texans. But even then, like, did they look good against the Texans?
They looked good in the first half.
There's an outside chance that the Texans are the worst team in the NFL also.
There's not a chance of that. Not with Deshaun Watson healthy. Your whole, like, you know, people who laughed about people saying that the Russell Wilson-led Seahawks were going to be the worst team in the NFL or one of the worst teams in the NFL, I say the same thing about Deshaun Watson-led Texans.
Where do you think the Texans rank in rush defense?
I don't know.
You think that, okay, so they did,
last week, Kirk Cousins was 16 of 22 for 260 yards. He averaged over 12 yards per pass attempt.
Houston is 27th. This is defensive DVOA.
And by the way, last week, Justin Jefferson and Adam Thielen both had over 100 yards. You're all like, oh, that'll never happen. That's implausible.
No, I explained to you what the scenario was. And the scenario is, I didn't say it was impossible.
They led that game the entire way!
I'm actually a little bit shocked by that. But
they were up 17-3 at one
Houston
point.
Houston was 29th in rush DVOA. Houston has a bad defense and a bad offense. A win over Houston means nothing to me.
You're putting too much weight on the last 4 weeks and not enough weight on previous seasons.
You mean when
the
Seahawks,
Texans,
oh, when
and
the
with
Seahawks
the Seahawks
beat the Vikings last year? Or when the Seahawks beat the Vikings the previous year?
I mean, I think they're probably going to win, but also it was, I don't know what the weather was in those games.
Oh,
so
my
fucking
God. You're so concerned with the weather? That's it. That is all of it. Like,
I mean, I haven't updated these stats in a while. But the Seahawks won like 95% of the time home games when it doesn't rain historically, and like 60% of the time home games when it rains. Like you are acting like this has not happened.
I'll even counter your rain theory. If it thunders and it rains and they delay the game, but then it clears up and then they play, I'll take
that. I'm very skeptical. The number of times that thunder is forecast in the weather for Seattle versus the number of times it actually happens is a pretty dramatic difference.
Houston is 27th in defensive DVOA and 20th in offensive DVOA. And they got lucky to they won by one score at home.
Also, we're very good on offense last year. Deshaun Watson has a long track record of being an effective quarterback.
They don't have DeAndre Hopkins anymore. Like, Houston is not the same team. They fired their coach after this game.
Well, they should have fired their coach. I agree with that. It's actually 80-90% that historically at the point I last updated, they'd won of dry home games, and 72% of rainy home games, which is right on what I would say is about my chances of victory of 70%.
Okay. What did I say, 82%?
You did.
Okay. Well, if they lose this game because of rain, then we'll discuss after. But hopefully,
I'm sure we will.
The Seahawks will go to 5-0 this week for the first time in franchise history. If things are exciting and fun, and the NBA Finals are over, is there a game scheduled for Sunday?
Oh, there sure is. Game 6 is scheduled for Sunday if the Heat can manage to extend the series on Friday.
Okay, well, if things are interesting and fun, and there isn't an NBA Finals game to conflict with it, we'll be back on Sunday. No, that game will be way over. This is
it's gonna be late. The Seahawks game starts after the NBA Finals game, so we'll do an emergency pod on Sunday. Otherwise,
we might do an emergency. I'm not willing to admit. Look, let's say that it's nighttime. Look, Russ is not losing this game. It is Sunday night. Have you met?
They are pretty
Russell
good in prime time.
Have you seen Russell Wilson play football? When was the last Sunday night game that Russ lost? I'll wait.
Well, there was the Cardinals game that we went to.
In 2014?
I'm just saying that's the first. There was a primetime game they lost to the Falcons at home where they missed a field goal at the end during 2017, I believe.
No, that wasn't a primetime game. That was Monday. That was a Monday night game.
Well, that's a primetime game.
I said, when was the last time they lost a Sunday night game at home?
I mean, I don't have that information at the top of my
head. Ever. Literally never. I don't even think they've lost a primetime game since 2017, though.
Well, they lost on Sunday Night Football. The final game of the 2019 season is the answer. I don't know if you're aware of that. They were playing against the San Francisco 49ers. The division was on the line.
You mean when Jacob Hollister scored that touchdown?
Oh, that's what you saw. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.